Welcome to the African Climate Breakdown podcast, a show on climate change with a particular focus on Africa. I'm your host, Dr. Suzanne Carter, and I lead the coordination unit of the Future Climate for Africa Research Program, or FCFA, a program that works to improve the understanding of how Africa's climate is changing, how that affects communities, and what can be done to create a climate-resilient future. Join us as we delve into the innovative research of FCFA and hear on-the-ground stories of climate change in Africa. In the last episode, we discussed the impact of climate change on our water resources and how we need to plan for climate change to ensure future water supplies, particularly for African cities. This time around, we will explore how cities across the continent are responding to the varying effects of climate change. My co-host today, Brenda Mwalukanga, is no stranger to those of you who have been following our series. In our last episode, Brenda joined us as a guest to discuss some of her experiences as an embedded researcher in Lusaka as part of the Fractal Project. Thank you for being here, Brenda. I'm looking forward to hearing more of your great insights. Can you tell us a bit about yourself and remind us about your role as an embedded researcher?
Thank you, Suzanne. I'm so happy to be here. As an embedded researcher, I fulfill the same role as Cornelia, who was the co-host on the previous podcast. Essentially, we are the bridges that communicate between policy and research. I worked within Fractal in Lusaka between the University of Zambia and Lusaka City Council under the City Planning Department. I worked as an embedded researcher for 4 years, and I first got involved in 2016. What I most enjoyed about the job was that I was moving between writing a lot of different products, blogs, articles, and actually continuing to practice as a planner within the city of Lusaka.
That's amazing. I think being in a position where you are working in between the academic and decision-making worlds is so important in dealing with climate change. Could you share some of your experiences? And what did you find most challenging and rewarding about being in this position?
The thing I found most challenging is that I needed to learn aspects that I wasn't deeply conversant with on the basis of my background being a social scientist. So I had to learn a lot of the climate science and how to communicate it from a technical aspect to more digestible pieces. But ultimately, I ended up appreciating it because Fractal required always using a learning approach. And as we continued, you come out with new bits of information that ultimately you benefit from. And what I found most rewarding is that 2 years after the Fractal project has ended, Lusaka decision makers and policy makers, technocrats, are still using some of the products that we co-developed during this project, such as the policy briefs, the climate narratives, some of the reports that we did around the learning labs and the dialogues. So for me, that was rewarding, and it's still rewarding.
Cities are particularly at risk to the impacts of climate change, but are also well positioned to lead the charge in delivering innovative solutions to tackle climate change. African cities have a difficult set of challenges to deal with: rapid population growth, as well as rapid environmental, economic, and social change, which present their own issues. And all of these are magnified by climate change. This is particularly relevant in rapidly expanding informal settlements, where a high number of people are concentrated in small areas that are often unplanned, lack access to basic services, and are particularly exposed to climate risks. Sub-Saharan Africa is regarded as the world's fastest urbanizing region. According to UN Habitat, urban areas in sub-Saharan Africa are currently home to over 500 million people and are likely to reach a billion, with the majority of Africa's population living in cities by 2035. With 55% of Africa's city dwellers already living in informal settlements or slums, the growing numbers of urban residents present a range of challenges and opportunities for the continent. Different cities across the African continent are dealing with this and other issues to varying degrees. The question is, how do cities deal with climate change while grappling with these existing challenges? As much as cities may be the epicenter of these challenges, they can also serve as hubs for the greatest change. In order to help us unpack some of the challenges and consider how we go about creating solutions, we've invited a number of FCFA researchers to discuss further the impacts of climate change on African cities. Along with Brenda's expertise, we're joined today by Dr. Maimuna Bologo Traore, a researcher and lecturer at the International Institute for Water and Environmental Engineering in Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso. She has been working with the AMA 2050 team to understand how communities respond to flooding in Ouagadougou. We also have Janito Maure, an associate professor at Eduardo Mondlane University in Maputo, Mozambique. Janito worked as a co-principal investigator as part of the Fractal project work in Maputo. Thank you both for joining us. Brenda, we've already alluded to the rapid growth of cities in Africa and how that means we have more people living in informal settlements. I wonder if you would tell us a bit more about this in the context of Lusaka and why informal settlements are so vulnerable to climate change.
Okay, so Lusaka is 70% informal. We have over 40 settlements within the city, but there should be about 34 wards or settlements that have come about due to informality. And this means that they lack basic services like infrastructure, proper housing, and even drainages, that even when a normal rainfall comes about, the water is not able to flow out. And more importantly, we have a majority of the people living within the city of Lusaka and highly densely populated informal settlements. And so the number of people that are affected by floods and that are vulnerable to climate change is also quite significant in terms of the numbers and population as well.
Maimouna, in our first episode, we learned a bit about megastorms in West Africa and how these intense storms are increasing the flood risks. Could you tell us more about flooding in Ouagadougou and how the community copes with flooding?
Okay, thank you to give me the floor. In the context of Ouagadougou, as you said, that due to the climate extremes, we are accentuated by the nature of the occupation of space, sanitation problem, and also the waste management. That are the different things who can accentuate the flooding risk. And we can have also the urban space planning in which waterways are not always sufficiently taken into account. That is the situation. And how the city prepare for the climate change? They have a normal national plan for adaptation about the issue. That is a national plan that applied in the city of Ouagadougou. We have some activity like the cleaning of the cleaning of the gutters, because every year when it is the time of during before the starting of raining season, the municipality paid for the cleaning of the different gutters in order that during the raining season this can have a clean place, allow water to go at the good way. Also, we can notice that they try to give some piece of advice for the different people in order to know what they can do everything be careful during the rainy season also. That is another aspect of the activity that the municipality, the city deal. And in which concerns specifically the different communities or for their own house, it depends. Sometimes some people move because they know that their house is in the flooding risk zone. They try to move and change. That is a person generally who are not the owners of their own house. And the other activity is to try to have a concrete around the house also, or to make specifically some wall in the cavity in the wall in order to allow the raining water to go out of the house component also. That is a kind of strategy developed by the people also.
Janito, Mozambique is no stranger to extreme climate events. In 2018, you had cyclones Idai and Kenneth causing major damage to the country. Could you tell us a bit about the kind of climate risks Maputo is facing both currently and what is expected in the future due to climate change?
So after Idai, what I would say is our awareness has again, taken to another level. So we are somehow, we have somehow gained knowledge on what climate impact can be. I mean, at different places in the country. So Idai happened in central Mozambique, and Kenneth in the northern part of Mozambique. You may be aware that Mozambique is like 2,800 kilometers of coastline. So there are different climate effects happening there. So for the case of Maputo, although we are in the southern tip of the country, we do face more or less the same problems, or at least we have a sort of a mixed kind of problems, because we are also hit by tropical cyclones, we are hit by wind gales, we are hit by droughts, so we are hit by urban flooding, peri-urban flooding. So this is the kind of events that we have to face in, like every two, every five, every 10 years, once and then we are always facing these kind of risks and we have to deal with them.
Janito, as part of the Fracto project, a health hazard map was developed for the city of Maputo. Could you tell us about the kind of health risks climate change poses to Maputo and how this digital tool can help the city respond to climate change?
As I mentioned before, if you are having floods, if you're having droughts, and if you're having, for example, strong winds, you're having different impacts on health. So what we were trying to focus on was on a tool that was mostly concerned with the diseases that are more frequently than those that are causing major damage. As you can imagine, we have major problems with cholera. We do have big problems with malaria, and so on. So the biggest one, we chose malaria because first, it's one of the, we call it mandatory reporting kind of disease. And second, because we were engaging with their partner during the Fracto project that was very much interested in predicting malaria outbreaks, we decided to choose malaria. So somehow we allowed them to form us, and together we collaborate in terms of producing this this tool. It's a tool that allows the decision makers to allocate proper logistics in terms of preparedness and response in case there is a hotspot that has been forecasted to have a malaria outbreak. So that allows the government, for example, to allocate means for spraying, for mosquito spraying. If that fails, it also allows the government to allocate the distribution of mosquito, to prioritize the distribution of mosquito nets, this kind of things. Yeah. And now that idea has been scaled up and is working together now with the Minister of Health. The Minister of Health doesn't want that to be only for Maputo, although the project was initially for Maputo. They have now involved the team and they want us to be working, I mean, countrywide.
Has this new system for the tool been enacted yet? Has there been a trigger where an event has happened and the protocols have been used yet, or is it still too early for that to have happened?
In fact, what happened is that we at the beginning we were facing issues with the data that we wanted to, because this is a tool that needs sort of data from past to be able to, I mean, just to fine tune it so that we know that okay, this tool is able to replicate what happened in the past. So it's a sort of a validation process it has to go through. And it was being very difficult to get this data. Now that the data is available, there is this will from the government to don't test it only in Maputo, because Maputo is not the only the biggest hotspot, in fact, is Nampula province. So what I did, I've got a master's student who is doing that for Nampula. We want him to validate that so that we can somehow deploy the system. He's now finalizing his MSc project, I think, hopefully that will allow us to get clearance to release the tool the way we wanted it to do.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'm going to ask a question of all three of you now. I wonder if you could each share with me some of your experiences about how best to engage with city decision makers to co-create solutions to climate risks. Can we start with Brenda?
Sure, Suzanne. I think what we learned within the city of Lusaka was the recognition that there are different types of decision makers within the city, ranging from policymakers, political decision makers, community members, and even technocrats. And we need to be cognizant of the fact that each of these come with their own mandates and interests that need to be taken care of. And as we discuss the impacts of climate change, some of them may give rise to tension and conflict that will need to be resolved. So going in to speak about climate change using a learning approach is also about conflict resolution and ensuring that that conflict and that tension is resolved, so that you come up with co-created solutions that deal not only with the physical responses to climate change, like drainages and, you know, better flood risk management or even pollution prevention, but also qualitative solutions such as perhaps having more platforms or forums where you can regularly discuss the problems that are manifesting due to climate change. So it's about recognizing the different interests, always coming in to ensure that you are willing to resolve the conflict, but also clearly communicating that the end result that we're looking for is co-creation and climate risk prevention and mitigation.
Thanks, Brenda. And Maimuna, what are your experiences?
Okay, for our experience in the AMA 2050 project, first of all, for the beginning of project activity, we have been in contact with the State Department and services in charge of urban planning issues, the meteorological services and the municipal authority. And also, I can add that we have also in contact with the National Committee of Emergency Issue. And with all of the different partners, and we made a contact with them. We did some surveys to carry out with the decision makers and the implication for the various information and communication activities we were carrying out to make it possible to identify and to take into account the expectation of decision-making as far as possible. The most important thing that during the different meeting, we continue to work together. And if officially, for example, AMA 2050 project is finished, I can say that we continue to collaborate because, for example, in September, we one person of our National Agency of Meteorology and the other one of Emergency Committee in Abidjan to talk about flooding area and flooding risk situation in the West Africa also. But that means that we are continuing to be in contact and working together.
Great. And Janito, I'm going to lastly go to you then about what you think is some of the key ways we should be engaging with city decision makers to co-create solutions.
I think the biggest experience I had so far in life in terms of learning, I'm coming from the natural science side, and sometimes we tend to be very dictatorial in terms of if you don't understand numbers, then I think you should, I mean, try to position yourself. And I learned a lot during this process. The first thing that you have to do is to be humble. Be humble. Once you start engaging with them, I think one of the things that you should do is to present them with a topic and let them speak first. Because they have their daily concerns and they want to solve a problem. They have got their own strategy, which is not wrong. But apparently it's failing because there are some misconceptions or poor understanding of some of the underlying aspects. So let them speak first and let them speak in their own language. You try to merge with the scenario, try to understand what they're doing, try to understand their language. And once you find a converging point of, let's say, of concern, because you're also concerned with your research and they are concerned with their daily activities, with their projects, with their plans. Once you find the sweet spot, then take off from there. Once you take off from there, you try to co-produce knowledge with them, support them, whichever means you are able to in their, let's say, if they're organizing, for example, an event and they want your facilitation skills to be part of it, just go there and support them. I think that is priceless. Yeah. At the end of the day, you see all gates are open. You go wherever you want. You have the meeting with people you never thought you would meet before.
That's fantastic. I think it really points from all of your responses that the key to all of this is the relationships. And you can't really do anything unless you have that strong relationship with your key decision maker. So that's the basis for co-creating a solution. I just want to thank all of you for your time today, for your great insights, and for sharing some of the great learning that's coming out of your different projects. To end off this discussion, let's hear about some of the challenges facing cities in East Africa. We've asked one of the High Crystal team members to tell us about some of the impacts of climate change on water, sanitation, and hygiene systems in Kampala, Uganda, and Kisumu, Kenya. Professor Barbara Evans is the Chair of Public Health Engineering at University of Leeds and leads High Crystal's urban work.
So I think when people think about climate risks and WASH, what they often think about is water supply and particularly water shortages. But perhaps a neglected issue is the impact of the increased risk of intense rainfall on urban infrastructure. So if we take Kisumu, for example, it has relatively low coverage of sanitation and quite significant parts of the system which are not fully joined up. So we have a lot of on-site systems, pits and tanks, which are frequently very full of fecal waste, may not have been emptied for quite some time. And many of those are situated in quite low-lying areas, particularly where low-income informal settlements are. So what we tend to see is a really serious intersection between flooding and inadequate sanitation. So you have populations, possibly already quite vulnerable populations, placed at risk in extreme flood events. But then on top of that, those floods are highly contaminated because the sanitation system is not complete and not working very well. So one of the things that we're really interested in is understanding how cities like Kisumu and Kampala can organise their sanitation services and other related infrastructure services better so as to mitigate the risk of this intersection between flooding and poor sanitation. We've been developing some models which couple together hydraulic flood models, and we can drive those with future climate predicted rainfall events so we can see how future flooding might change as rainfall becomes more intense, as the rainy seasons change in duration. So you might get more intense rainfall falling on more saturated ground. And then we can couple those modified flood models with information about the sanitation system. We can also look at how future population growth might change. So we can start to see how a future flood event, which is overlaying an inadequate sanitation system, might result in increased direct health risk, health and well-being risk to the population. What we're able to do with those models is then look at what different policy interventions might do in terms of alleviating some of the worst effects of those climate-driven changes in the future. So we've been looking, for example, at the implications of more actively managing sanitation systems. So we move a lot of the fecal waste out of the area more regularly so that when a flood occurs, there's just less pollutant, less fecal matter, and therefore less hazard in the environment where people are. We've also been looking at whether or not there's critical access infrastructure. So, for example, roads, culverts, drainage, which can be resized so that in a flood event or in anticipation of a second flood event, for example, you could guarantee there'll be access for sludge trucks so that we can actively go into areas which have been already badly affected by flooding and poor sanitation. We can do a cleanup very rapidly, which renders the whole situation less vulnerable if a second flood is to arrive. The way we've done this is through these very simple coupled models so that we're able to talk to the technical teams in a very sophisticated way, but also talk to politicians and look at how we might be able to reduce, even from today's baseline levels, the health implications of poor sanitation through these active management approaches. And of course, we can also look at what would happen if we shift people from one type of sanitation to another. So if we were to shift a lot of people who have large pit latrines at the moment to using container-based systems, which can be much more actively managed more easily, or shifting people to sewage systems, all of those things can then be looked at in terms of the direct benefits that we can attribute to future climate changes. We're really interested, actually, in the fact that what this does is it brings together not only the public health teams and the infrastructure teams, but also municipal government and community groups to think about the role that communities can play in flood awareness, the role of behaviour change in terms of mitigating these risks. And the other thing that's been really positive about this experience is that we've collaborated with several other major research projects which have been going on, particularly in Kampala. So we've been able to collaborate with several other major research projects which are being carried out in Kampala. And what's been really great is to see how the local authority, Kampala City Council, and the water utility have been really making use of opportunities to engage with research groups, not just the High Crystal team, but also other groups looking at how health risks are propagated by the sanitation system. So it's really nice to see the work of High Crystal leveraging together with other projects funded from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, for example, to really give us a very rich picture of how sanitation and the climate are interacting and how we can really think about redesigning the system to improve future resilience to weather-related shocks.
It's clear that cities have the potential to be the front runners in providing innovative solutions to climate change. But how do we get cities to plan a proactive strategy against climate change? We've invited Dr. Wilma Nanchito, a co-principal investigator on the Fractal Project and a lecturer in the Geography Department at the University of Zambia, to weigh in on this subject. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. Let's jump right in. Wilma, the Fractal Project specifically looked at how we can get cities to consider climate information when making decisions. I wonder if we could start by asking you what your thoughts are on cities being well-placed to lead in delivering the solutions to climate change.
For us in Lusaka City, I think we felt that cities are best placed because cities are centers of decision-making, whether it's central government or the private sector or NGOs. They usually have their headquarters, they usually have their experts based in cities. So when it comes to finding the solutions, these people are the best suited to come together and come up with the solutions for climate change. Cities also have a wide range of actors and the high densities. And you find that they will invariably have a large number of innovative ideas which can be gleaned from these people who live in the cities. And if you find a solution, a city will provide a large number of people who can be impacted by that solution. So for us, these are some of the reasons we felt that cities are best placed to produce the knowledge and also to test the knowledge once it had been produced in the context of climate change. So in summary, I think cities have the means and they also have the numbers to deal with the solutions to climate change.
In fact, though, we used a city learning approach where we used learning labs, city dialogues and embedded researchers to co-explore burning issues in cities like Lusaka and co-deliver solutions. Dr. Nchito, could you please tell us about the city learning process in Lusaka and explain what these learning labs and city dialogues are?
So since we knew that from the onset, we needed to get buy-in on these climate issues from the key stakeholders in the city, we needed to get them to sit at the same table, so to speak, so that we could understand what they knew about climate issues and where they thought the main problems were. And the learning lab approach, which was already being used in South Africa, seemed to be the best solution or the best approach to get all these various stakeholders sitting at the same table and talking. So between 2016 and 2019, the Lusaka Fractal team, which in itself was a very multidisciplinary team, held several learning labs. This approach uses various activities. It also uses brainstorming sessions, to not only learn from the people who are talking, but to also create knowledge. Because when people are talking, sometimes they'll say things which they think are not important, but to you who's listening, they are very important issues and they give you the light bulb moments. So we would have over maybe 20 experts, people from different institutions, government institutions, we had private sector, and we also had people from the grassroots. So we got a wide range of people. We would take them out of their normal spaces, have them sit together, and usually it was over 2 days, sometimes even 3 days, talking and discussing these issues. So for us in Lusaka, we had the inaugural learning lab, which was setting the tone and bringing out the burning issues. So the participants themselves discussed over hours, had activities over climate change, and they came up with 8 burning issues initially, which were whittled down to 4. So learning labs allow the participants themselves to come up with the idea. It's not a top-down approach. It allows people involved in the city to brainstorm and to come up with what they all agree are the main issues which were affecting the city of Lusaka around climate change. And from there, after the burning issues were agreed upon, the following learning labs started investigating these 4 different burning issues. So for instance, in Lusaka, we had inadequate water supply and sanitation at city scale. We had declining groundwater. We had increasing flooding. And the 4th one was groundwater pollution as the main burning issues. So for each learning lab, would then from then on have experts dealing in these various issues, giving a talk, and then again would brainstorm. We try to find ways around how, as a city, we can solve these problems. The learning labs also included field trips. So, for instance, if we're looking at water supply, in Lusaka, we had a field trip to Iolanda, which is the main uplift for our water for the city from the Kafue River. So even if people live in Lusaka, you realize that they don't really know where their water comes from. And the minute you show them where their water comes from, that makes them have this connection, and it makes them want to care for it even more. So the learning lab is a two-way process. We as the researchers were learning, and the participants were also learning quite a bit.
The learning lab approach seems to have been really fundamental in transforming the relationships between the sort of researchers and the city officials. Could you maybe give us a bit more information about what kind of climate information the city of Lusaka decided to use in the end, and what sort of things that influenced having that kind of climate information?
For us in the city, working under Fractal, we got climate information from CSAG. It was very, very detailed, very, very technical. And of course, we asked them to present it in a simpler manner where a lay person could understand it. And I think CSAG did a good job, because within our Lusaka team, we had a member from there. And the explanations on future predictions of climate change, future predictions of rainfall, future predictions of temperature were given. Because that's the easiest information that someone can understand. If you tell someone that it's going to be hotter, they will open their eyes and listen to you. And it will be hotter by 2 degrees. They'll listen even more. If you tell someone that we'll have rainfall variability, where we have shorter rainy seasons, but more intense. And intense rainfall in a shorter period means flooding. The local authority would listen, because they know that flooding means problems for them. So we used that level of analysis, a very basic interpretation, so that the lay person could understand in our presentations. But they were also technical. There were these graphs which showed the predictions over a 10-year period. There were also graphs showing the rainfall for the past 100 years, showing us that we've been facing a decrease in rainfall in the city. So if you're an expert from the water utility, you'll be worried about your groundwater levels if someone from a climatologist is telling you that. So that's the type of climate information that we used.
Could you give us an example of how Lusaka has benefited from this?
Lusaka has benefited from this because, for instance, we were fortunate as a city project under Fractal. We worked together with Lusaka Water Security Initiative, which is called LUSI. LUSI is a collaborative platform which brings together various stakeholders who are all interested in ensuring that Lusaka is a water secure city. So under the Fractal project, we worked closely with LUSI, and we were able to share our information, for instance, the climate change information with the partners, with the stakeholders under LUSI, and also create awareness for them on what the scenarios are in terms of Lusaka and climate change in future.
Fractal played an important role in getting cities to be open and receptive to including climate change considerations, but projects like Fractal only run for a limited time period. In your opinion, what needs to still happen in the long term for cities like Lusaka to become more resilient to climate change?
Yes, like all projects, they don't last forever. But for instance, I talked about the learning lab process and how effective it was. For us in Fractal, we worked closely with a collaborative platform within Lusaka. It's called the Lusaka Water and Security Initiative. So we were already working with people who are invested in ensuring that there's water security in the city. And of course, they acknowledge the fact that climate change will affect water security, and they also acknowledge that energy will also affect climate change. So we're already on the same level with this collaborative platform. And from the Fractal project, we ended up training. There was a realization that if we're going to have change in the city, the city councillors needed to get involved because they are the change makers, especially on the ground. They are the ones who make the decisions. For instance, they give land where they're not supposed to give land, and it turns into flooding. So we thought we can make all these policies in our offices, but if we don't get to these people and tell them the impacts or teach them the impacts of climate change, we're not going to be successful. So for us in Fractal, we held the training of councillors in climate change, which went on well. And I think the councillors appreciated the impact, and they accepted the fact that sometimes they were to blame. So when you've trained a councillor, they will also speak to their people. So that would be a continuity. So there's some level of trickle down of knowledge into the community. So we expect that there are some people in the community who appreciate that they shouldn't build in certain areas, they shouldn't fill up the drainages, and because it will cause flooding. So that's one side of how Fractal will, the impact of Fractal will continue in the long term, because we've disseminated that knowledge down to a certain level of people within the community. On the other hand, we've also built relationships. Remember, I talked about having someone from the grassroots talking to an expert within a government institution. So these relationships have continued. We've seen them continue within Fractal, where if someone in the grassroots is having an issue, for instance, there's flooding in there, they know who to call in the local authority. Or if someone from the water utility is having problems moving people off their land, or people are encroaching their land, they know who to call within the local authority, or they know who to call within the community itself. So these collaborative relationships have come out of Fractal, and in some way, we have seen them continue. And so Fractal, though it ended, the impact is still being felt. But however, there must be, at the end of the day, the role of central government in all this. So central government must lead the way. So we in Fractal we wrote 4 policy briefs, which were taken to a higher level, where we've talked about the 4 burning issues and what is happening and what needs to be done. So the next stage is for government to take responsibility and come up with measures, come up with policies which will make the city more resilient. And they need to make decisions which which take into consideration all the different actors.
Thank you, Wilma, for sharing the excellent work that you do. What an interesting episode. So much is happening in African cities to tackle climate risks. Brenda, what are your key insights from these conversations?
Two things that stood out for me is the importance of having expertise close to decision makers, to recognize that climate scientists are the ones that usually have the information, but the ones that will implement the change are often the people that you may not expect. For example, community members that have the influence. And this is exactly why it's important to bridge the gap between research and practice. Secondly, a tailor-made approach is important in different cities because each city is responding to a unique set of challenges and risks, and so the solutions need to fit the context.
For me, the key message is that African cities are facing multiple challenges. So to get climate resilience on the agenda, strong relationships between city officials, communities, and researchers are absolutely critical. High levels of trust and humility are needed to work effectively together. Knowing who to coordinate with is a really important step to make sure actions happen on the ground. We've come to the end of this episode. Thank you for tuning in. We would love to hear from our listeners. And if you have any burning questions or comments, please email info@futureclimateafrica.org. If you'd like to learn more about the work mentioned on this podcast, please visit futureclimateafrica.org. You can also follow us on Twitter on the handle @future_climate or on LinkedIn under Future Climate for Africa. Take a look at the podcast show notes for any of the links you may have missed. Join us again next time for more groundbreaking African climate research and stories.